Welcome, everybody. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class for November 2012. Just a reminder again, for sound quality, if you could mute yourself by pushing *6, and unmute yourself by pushing *7. That's going to make it a lot easier for us to hear our guest today. This is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and this is the Right Now Mastermind class. Our class today is How to Write a Bestseller, Even If You Never Took a Writing Class. Our guest is Julie Cantrell, author of Into the Free. New York Times and USA Today bestselling author Julie Cantrell was the editor-in-chief of the Southern Literary Review. She has been a freelance writer for a decade and has contributed to more than a dozen books. Julie and her family now live in Oxford, Mississippi, where they operate Valley House Farm. A speech-language pathologist and literacy advocate, Julie also was honored to receive the 2012 Mississippi Arts Commission Literary Fellowship and is working on a creative nonfiction book about her family's adventures as first-generation farmers. Her second novel will be published by David C. Cook and is set to follow her best-selling debut, Into the Free. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
It's great to have you here. So let's just start by, I'd love to hear how you started writing. What are your beginnings as a writer?
Okay, well, I have always written since I was a little girl. I remember just writing in journals, writing letters, climbing into my tree in the backyard and writing about what was going on in my life and what was going on in the world around me and the people that I lived by and the people in my family. And it was just kind of my way of processing the world and all the things that I couldn't understand or needed further grasp of. Writing was my tool to do that. And I've always been a reader. So as I've grown, reading and writing has always been very important to me. When I went into high school my freshman year, I had a wonderful English teacher named Linda Purcell, and she gave us an assignment to read To Kill a Mockingbird, still one of my favorite books by Harper Lee. And our assignment was to write a journal as if we were one of the characters from To Kill a Mockingbird. So I was Scout, of course, and that was my first experience to write from the point of view of another person, to get into the head of a different character and explore the world as if I was someone else. And I just fell in love with that concept and that experience. It was so beautiful to me. So I really, really fell in love with fiction writing in ninth grade and became just a big reader. I devoured all the novels I could find and just practiced with that idea. But by the time I got to my senior year in high school, I had a different kind of English teacher who degraded me every day and ripped apart writing in front of the class every single day and used me as an example of a bad writer and how not to write. And she just pretty much destroyed every hope I had of ever writing. And on the last day of school, when I left high school, I'd won a little scholarship. You know, I was going to go to college on a scholarship. And she pulled me to the side and said, "I hope you don't waste your scholarship to study writing, because you may publish a greeting card, but that'll be it."
Wow.
And so I believed her. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you have people like that in your life. You're always going to have people who tell you can't and that you're not good enough. And I grew up in a very little town in Louisiana. I'd never known anyone who was a writer. There was enough reason for me to doubt it could be done. So when she told me that, I believed her, and I never took a writing class. I never studied writing. I never wrote another thing except for my class assignments for years. Nothing. And even though it had been such a huge part of my life before that, I just didn't do it anymore. And when I was pregnant with my first child, I started writing again, a journal to her, and that's what got me back into writing. But I would have never written to publish or do anything like that if it hadn't been for a friend who dared me. I was part of a MOPS group for mothers of preschoolers. We've moved around a lot when our kids were young. And MOPS offered an international organization for moms, and it offered a writing contest every year. And they had a contest for like each chapter to have the most entries. You'd win a little prize for your chapter. So someone dared me to enter. And that's how it all started. I won that contest, and MOPS contacted me to write for them more, and I started writing for their magazine, Mom Sense, and built a freelance career off of that. And then I just started taking any and every assignment I could possibly take so I could stay home with my children and write from home.
Oh, what a cool story. So you got into publishing doing freelancing. How did you make the jump from doing articles and other freelance assignments to doing books?
Well, Right. I started off just writing materials for parents. And I'm a speech-language pathologist. That's what I got my master's in and my certification. And I care very much about literacy and child development, language development, all of that. So I wrote a lot about parenting, family, and education, which is kind of my niche. I said we moved a lot. When we moved to Mississippi, my daughter was 6 years old, and we moved from Boulder, Colorado area, and she did not transition very well, and she had a really hard time sleeping in her new room and going to bed at night. She was terrified. So I sat down with her at our little computer and used stock photos of animals and printed out this little story that we wrote together, and we printed it out, stapled together, and called it the Emily Book. And we read it every night to help her go to sleep and get over her fears of nighttime. And as she made friends and people came to sleep over, we'd still read it. They wanted copies. And it kind of just spread through word of mouth. Different parents, teachers, and friends started asking me for copies of it and telling me that it was helping their kids too. So just as a mom who wanted to help my kid and help other kids, I thought I'd been freelancing for about 10 years. I kind of had my toes in that world but had never thought of publishing a book. I didn't know anything about it. But I started paying attention to books on the shelves that were kind of like that and started writing down which agents represented those authors and made myself a list after researching those agents from the top down who I wanted to represent me. And that book happened to be about God, so it needed to be an agent or a publisher that was comfortable publishing something about faith. And I found Greg Johnson. He was the top agent on my list. I contacted him, and he took it, and that's who I'm still with today. So it just worked out. Luck.
Wow.
I got really.
You did get lucky. That's an amazing story. So tell us just a little bit about Into the Free for people who maybe haven't heard of it, and then how the idea for the book came about. Where did it pop up from?
Well, that kind of stems back to that same year when we moved to Mississippi. I was looking for things to do with our family around the state, weekend trips and stuff, and I came across a one or two sentence little blurb about a gypsy queen who had been buried in Meridian, Mississippi. And that fascinated me. I'd never heard of any gypsies in the South. Now I know that they prefer to be called Roma or Romani travelers. I lived in Louisiana all the way up from birth through grad school, so I'm a Southern girl and had never known any Roma, as far as I knew, and was just fascinated by the concept. So years later, when I write a novel on my bucket list and just sat down to do it for myself as a personal goal, that idea came back to me. I'd always had it in the back of my head that I wanted to know more about who the Roma were in the southeast region of the United States. Were they still here? What brought them here? What was that story? And so I kind of started just reading what I could find about the Roma and learned a lot about it. We went down to visit Kelly Mitchell's grave. On her gravestone, it says Kelly Mitchell, Queen of the Gypsies. And when she was buried in Meridian in 1915, more than 20,000 people came to her funeral from all across the country and Central and South America. And I was just fascinated by that. Now, the Roma ended up being, the Gypsies come through this story as a small thread of the story, but it ends up being part of a much larger world. And the story is all about my main character, Millie Reynolds, and she interacts with these Gypsies as they come and go. But it all started with that one blurb. You know, I think if your inspiration can come from anywhere, but things like that interest you and you want to learn more about, I love writing about things I don't know anything about because it's my way of learning.
That's great. So what was the process of kind of writing the book and then getting it accepted and published? What did that look like? Did you do all the editing before? Did you do it after it was accepted? What was that story? What's the story behind that?
Because I had no clue what I was doing. I really didn't follow any of the rules that you've heard everywhere else, that now I know. Everything that everybody says about how you're supposed to go about writing and publishing a book, I didn't do any of that because I didn't know. I'd never really looked into how to publish a book. I didn't even write the book with a goal of publishing it. I never planned to show anybody this book. It was just that I had always been a big reader, and I think like a lot of readers, we read books and go, I wonder if I could do that. And maybe there's a book in me. And so it was really just a personal goal of mine. I am, I just turned 39, so I wrote this book when I was 35, and I had hit that kind of milestone point in my life where I started thinking I'm running out of time to do all the things in life I want to do. I better get started. And that was one of the things. So I am so busy teaching, farming, parenting. I'm a huge volunteer with our literacy council. I didn't really have time to write a book, plus all the freelance stuff I still do. So I carved myself a goal of 3 months, and I got up and wrote between 3 and 5 in the mornings before our day started. And nobody really knew what I was doing or knew that I was doing it. I didn't plan to tell anybody. But when it was done, I loved the story and the characters so much that I thought I would show my agent, Greg Johnson, who had represented those two children's books I did three years earlier, and just see what he thought. And maybe he could advise me on what to do or whether it was worth moving forward or what to do with it. I had no idea. So I sent him my first draft. And actually, I think I just sent him like the first chapter or the first few chapters after he told me he'd be willing to look at it. And then he asked for the rest, and I sent it to him, and he loved it and asked if he could agent it. And we got very lucky. Greg is also, you hear all the horror stories all the time from writers about they had 78 rejection letters and all of this. I don't have that kind of story either, because Greg's the kind of agent that kind of shields his authors from the pain of the process, and he handles all of that. So if I ask him, did I get a rejection, he would tell me, but he's not going to call me every day and tell me that publishers are rejecting me. So I happened to see Greg recently, and I asked him, I said, people ask me a lot how many rejections I got, and I said, I really don't know that. Do you know? And he said, I think it was around 5. So there were about 4 or 5 publishers who saw it, didn't take the bite, and I will never know who, I could know who they are, but there's no point in that for me. But I was very, very lucky that David C. Cook, who is a Christian publisher, took the bite, and their acquisitions editor, John Blaze, took a really big risk on this book, and has just, the whole company has just been so supportive of me from the start. I can't even imagine a more supportive team or better people to work with. It's been a perfect fit for me, so I'm really grateful for that. It's been fun.
So what kind of work did you do between, sending the first draft to your agent and it getting accepted and then the book coming out? And I don't know how long that period was, but what did you do to get the book ready for being published?
Okay, well, the process kind of goes like this. First, you have to get an agent, which, as I said, if you don't have an agent, start to notice the kind of book that you want to write and what books are on the shelves now that you like, and notice who those authors are and who is representing them as literary agent. And then you kind of make yourself a list and or a spreadsheet of who you want to contact as an agent. And there's a whole series of steps you go through to getting an agent. So first, you query them, and then they might ask for more from you, pitches or proposals. It's different for every agent, and you can learn a lot more about that process. That's a whole class in itself. But once you get an agent, then the agent works with you on getting a project ready to pitch to a publisher. So once Greg decided he liked this book enough to go try to sell it to a publishing company, we had to get it ready to do that. So he gave me some suggestions on some edits, pretty general stuff. We did that, and we put together a full proposal. And my advice in the proposal would be make it as thorough and detailed as you possibly can. That's your one shot to convince that publisher that they want to invest in you and your story. And so to me, I think what they really, really look at more than anything else is your marketing plan and how you're going to reach out and get this story to people, because it really isn't all on them to do that. As authors, unfortunately, we have to help market our books. That's not the fun part for me. It's pretty icky for me. But they count on us to be able to do that and to make connections and relationships with our readers. Now, the relationship part I love. I love people and I love connecting with my readers. I've never been a person who likes fundraisers and selling things and money and all of that. So that part is icky to me, but you have to kind of figure it out and think it through and show them that you're willing to learn about marketing that book and what you're going to do on your end to do it.
And what were some of the things that you put in your marketing plan that you felt like were really essential for helping you?
No, I can't remember specifically what I put in that proposal, but I can just tell you in general what I've done as to help market my book. To me, like for example, I have another friend who's a debut author who's done a great job and her book's doing well, but she came at it from a whole different perspective. Hers was, she's very goal-oriented, and she had specific goals about sale numbers she wanted to reach and speaking venues she wanted to reach and that kind of thing. I'm not. I came at it from the whole other angle that if one person read it, I would be thrilled and grateful. And if this story reached one person who needed to read it and it changed their life in a positive way, then I was grateful. For me, it was that kind of attitude and angle. So I didn't, for me, and really I encourage people to feel that way. Like, I've seen people get caught up with the wrong goals and the wrong angle, and it's never enough. Like, first they want a certain agent, and then they want a certain kind of advance or a certain contract with a certain publisher, and they get that. And then they want certain sales numbers or starred reviews or bestseller list, and then they want awards and recognition, and then they want big speaking fees, and then they want film rights and foreign rights. It's never enough to satisfy that craving that they have for success or for recognition. And I think if that's your goal, you're never going to get enough of it to make you happy. But if your goal is to share a story with other people who love story, then you're going to be satisfied as a writer, because readers love good stories and they just want more of it. And that's my goal. So what have I done to reach those readers? Compared to my friend, who, it's not right or wrong, we just have different perspectives, she will not take a speaking engagement for anything less than $750 per speech, per event. I come at it an entirely different way. For me, I look at it as if every single reader counts. So if I can connect with one reader, that's good to me. So I will do everything I can within my own time restraints and ability to reach readers. So if that means going to book clubs and meeting with a group of six women in someone's living room, yeah, I'll do it. And if it means Skyping into a book club across in Minnesota, I'll do it. I mean, it takes 45 minutes of my night, but I've reached six people on a level that they wouldn't have been able to have before. I love going to libraries and talking to library groups. They might, maybe nobody in that room bought the book. Maybe they all checked it out from the library. But if they loved the story and they connect with you, it meant something to them personally, and that means something to me. So I gain in different ways than monetary value and sales. But if you want to look at it in numbers and marketing perspective, every one of those people in that room will probably leave and talk about your book or talk about it. And that kind of word-of-mouth grassroots effort for me has been very, very helpful. I don't think of publishing or writing as a solo sport. I think of it as a team sport. And there's no way anybody can have a bestseller without a lot of supportive readers. That's what gets on those charts, the readers. So
that's
to me,
great.
Every reader counts.
Well, let's back up again from kind of the whole marketing thing and go back to that crafting a novel, because I think there's a lot of things you did in your novel that made it that crafted it into a bestseller, that crafted it into that kind of a story that people love. So do you want to talk about the kind of work you did in the 3 years it took to edit the book? What did you do to make it that kind of a story?
Yep, and I completely agree with you. I think one of my friends who's a great writer, Neil White, talks about when he teaches workshops, the art versus the craft of writing. And I think that's essential to understand, and it's something I didn't know when I wrote my book. I'm learning it. I'm still learning it. But another friend of mine, Katie Anderson, who's another writer, gave me the book Save the Cat by Blake Snyder. Just said I read that. And that was my tool that I turned to again and again and again to move from the art of just organically putting the story down on paper to the craft of turning it into a page-turning, best-selling kind of book. My tendency is to read literary novels. So I could write 3 pages on describing a tree, and I love that. I love rich, detailed language. I love the classics. But I know that that's not really what people want to read a lot right now. People like me do, but in general, no. So in order to turn it into a book that was going to keep people's interest and keep them turning pages and boil it down to the bones, I used Save the Cat by Blake Snyder, and it is a book on screenwriting, actually, not novel writing, but I like to write in visual scenes. I'm very visual. I want to picture that as if it's a scene on a film book. I want to picture the characters and the environment, and to me, especially coming from a Southern literary background, I think the character should be so rich. The setting should be so rich it's one of the characters. So I follow that when I write a scene. Blake Snyder gives you a step-by-step beat sheet program, basically a structure to follow. But it's based on the traditional 3-act plot structure. And there's another book by James Scott Bell, and he's a He does a lot of great how-to write books, but his on plot and structure by James Scott Bell is another great book to kind of map out the plot structure of a novel and get that craft down to the detailed structure that it needs to be. I've learned a lot about three-act plot structure, and if there's anything I can recommend to a writer like me who came at it not knowing anything, just learning through trial and error, that would be key. It's got to have, I think, the right pacing and the right structure and the arc of that structure. And to me, I love the way Blake Snyder breaks down that each scene kind of ends on a positive or negative note, and I love that it alternates. So if it starts out with a negative, it ends with a pro, and then your next one is going to start with a pro and end with a negative. So you're constantly moving the reader back and forth emotionally throughout the whole book. And I love that I really strive to make my scenes, or especially my chapters, each chapter its own little mini arc as well within the overall arching structure of the book. So you've got your beginning, your middle, and your ending with your climax for the overall book, but you kind of have that in each chapter as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So I'm constantly giving readers peaks and plummets, and I'm constantly trying to end each chapter so that they need more. I want to leave them. I kind of compare it to when you go to a really fine restaurant and you go for like a tapas menu, for example, and they bring you one little tiny serving of something decadent and wonderful and delicious. And you, everything is charged around that one little tiny three-bite serving of something, and you love it, and you can't wait to see what comes next. You might not know what's coming next, but you want more. You're not full, and you know it's going to be good. And then maybe it wasn't as good as the first one, but you know that something else is coming, and so you're going to wait and see if maybe that's as good or better. And so you're constantly anticipating something you don't know to come. But there's constant rise and fall of those emotions.
That's really a great image. I love it. And what did you do?
Were very helpful for me. I'm going to say them again just in case people didn't get it.
Yeah.
Save the Cat by Blake Snyder and Plot and Structure by James Scott Bell.
I think those are really helpful. Thank you.
And after I wrote the whole book and went back and structured the whole thing, I also went back to a storyboard at the very end, which I just finished first round edits for my second novel, and that's where I am now. So after I get the whole story down on paper, and then I structure the whole story based on a plot structure, three-act structure, then I kind of storyboard the whole thing and make sure that I've got those each individual scene and chapter and piece structured the way I want it, with those positives and negatives and the endings that want you to continue. Every little piece has to kind of be broken down into chunks then and put together. Some people do all that from the beginning, and they outline from the beginning that way and then fill in the scenes around it. But I'm the opposite. I have to kind of get the story down first. I start with a character and a setting. I build everything around that, and then I go back and fix the plotting and the pacing.
Wow.
Some people do it the other way around. But to me, the essence of the story is the character, and then everything else built around that.
Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about what tools you use to kind of help you kind of build character and setting. What helps you get those rich, deep characters that readers want to get to know and kind of hold on to?
You know, I wish I had. There are a lot of people who rely on, there's so much on character online that you can find, like personality checklist and questionnaires that you go in and you dive down and you want to know kind of what each character's flaws are, what each character's lies and truths are. There's all different ways of wording, you know, the essence of your character. I think that's all very, very helpful, and I have to admit I haven't ever used that. I think my characters have just come to me so richly and organically that I kind of just follow their lead in my head and see where they take me. And I just kind of watch their quirks come to me. I wish I could say there was a trick to that, and I think a lot of people use really effective, efficient tools to it, but so far my characters have all been pretty organically born, and I don't know why. I think I just love people. I've always been drawn to all sorts of people, so I've always kind of had broad, sweeping circles of friends and all over the world and all different backgrounds, and all of those colors come together, I guess, in my head to build some of those characters. None of them are based on real people, but I guess different things that I've known or seen in real life, I guess, kind of build them for me.
Wow. And so if we're working on our writing, what tools would you recommend we do, or what should we do to improve our writing?
Well, I think that changing it from the art to the craft is key. First of all, you have to get the art. You have to uncensor yourself and not think about. Now, I know people who outline are going to say the opposite, and they come at it from a different angle. But for me, the only way to get to a true story, the real nuggets of the story, is to not think about who your audience is going to be, what genre label is going to be attached to it, any kind of word number restraints or anything. No, don't restrain yourself at all. Write it as if you're the only person who is ever going to read that book, really, and just put everything that comes through you on that page. Really tap into the creative spirits of those characters that you're creating and that world that you're inventing. As authors, as I said, writing is a team sport. And it takes many, 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 many people to get a book from concept to shelf. And it's always kind of shameful to me that my name's the only one on the cover, because I think that's sinful. I think so many people should be on that cover that touched this book from the time it sparked in my head. But ultimately, we're the ones that create this world that doesn't exist anywhere else except in our head. And in order to really create that world vibrantly and fully, we have to just go there without restraint. So if we limit ourselves and the whole time we're writing, we're thinking about plot structure and word number and who's going to buy it and what color the cover's going to be and everything else that we get bogged down in later in the process, we won't get the real story on paper. So first, just write the story. And then you can go back and put it into however you want to do it, through outlining or plot structuring or storyboarding, whatever your tools are that you want to use. But first, just write the story and don't worry about anything else, any edits at all.
Oh, that's great. That's great advice.
I also,
go ahead.
Teamwork, crucial for me, is to have really, really good, honest critique partners before it moves through the whole editing phase. So I have been very lucky, and they're going to be, with Into the Free. Of course, I was a debut author. I didn't know any authors to ask. I knew a couple from here in Oxford, but they wrote different kinds of stuff. But I didn't know people. I had never gone to conferences. I wasn't part of a writer's group. I didn't have a critique partner circle or anything. All of that would be wonderful. But because I came at it backwards, I didn't have any of that. I very much emphasize the benefit of having a good critique partner. At least one, I would say two or three, would be helpful. Maybe one real critique partner and then a couple of early readers. And I chose my early readers across a broad spectrum. So I purposely chose different kind of readers that wrote different things, that were had different kinds of backgrounds, different educations, different ages, different genders, everything. And they gave me different perspectives. Because reading is so subjective, it was interesting to get all of that feedback before it ever went through the final phases of editing and kind of incorporate what I could to reach a bunch of different kinds of readers.
Oh, great advice. So do you have a sense of what are the characteristics of a best-selling book? What are things that make books bestsellers?
Well, I think there's a lot that goes into that. I think, first of all, it's really easy. I've heard so many writers over the years, or people say the same thing about top 40 hits. None of that's good music. And bestseller books, well, they're not really good books. I disagree, especially after coming through it. I've always, as I said, come from a literary background. So I read literary novels. I never really read a lot of the more, a lot of literary novels. Some of them have made bestsellers, so I can't say I didn't read bestsellers. But that wasn't my goal, to go read people that had published a bunch of bestsellers. That's not necessarily what drew me to a book. But now that I see kind of what readers want and what readers are drawn to, I realize how much work it takes to boil a story down to that and get the pacing right and get the structure right. There's a lot of work that goes into crafting that story that way. So what comes across as seeming a little simple or basic or boiled down didn't start that way. It took a lot to get it there, and I think that all of those authors should be very highly commended for that craft. It's a craft. But I do think there are things that keep people talking about a story, and for first of all, they have to care about the characters. If you don't care about that character, if we don't, as readers, care about that character, then we're not going to take our time and go on that journey with that character. So we have to deliver believable, honest, genuine, interesting characters to people, and they have to be richly developed, or we're not going to spend our time with them. The one thing that's great about reading is we get to choose who we're going to spend our time with, unlike the real world. So we want to be with people that we care about, and we want to see them, you know, win in the end. My ending, that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be a happy fairy tale ending either. There's lots of different ways books can end, and they don't always have to have that perfect fairy tale ending. Mine does not. And so you don't think you have to have that to have a bestseller. I disagree completely. So aside from readers, I mean, the characters, I think, like I said, when you boil it down to the bones and get the craft, the trick is to keep the momentum building throughout the whole book so that people have to keep turning the page. I love to hear people tell me they devoured my book, or they couldn't put it down, or it was a page turner, or they read it in one night, or they read it in two nights. I love hearing that from my readers. To me, that means I hit that sweet spot. I kept their interest, I kept them caring, and I kept them turning the pages. They didn't get bored or put it down, and they had to come back to it if they did. So that, to me, is a real goal for a bestseller. And
wow.
Then, like I said, the pacing and the structure is very, very important to keep that to keep the momentum and the emotions constantly going up and down. I think that's key. We want an emotional ride when we read a book. Most of us do.
That's great. So I read recently on Goodreads about how hard it is for readers to discover these debut novels, because there's so many of them, and some are self-published and some are traditionally published, and it's a little bit overwhelming as a reader. What do you think helped to get your book noticed when it came out as a debut novel?
Right, and I think that's key. And especially now, you know, more and more people are trying self-publishing. Readers don't always know if a book is self-published or published by a traditional press, especially online. They kind of all blend together. And unless you're really in the publishing world, you don't usually even notice who a publisher is necessarily, unless you're a really avid reader and you've cared and tuned in. A lot of readers don't, they could never tell you who published any of the books that they've read. So it all gets kind of blurred together, and it's, I mean, I think Amazon has over 8 million titles on their shelves right now, if I remember correctly, and they're on their digital shelves. So can you imagine you're a debut author and your book title just gets thrown out there among those 8 million titles, and nobody's heard of you, and nobody's looking for you, and nobody's searching you? How are they going to find your book? They never will. You're a needle in a haystack. So to me, there's several things. Like I said before, the grassroots effort of reaching one reader at a time and having that word of mouth is very key, but my publisher, David C. Cook, again, has been so supportive of me and really put a lot behind marketing this book in smart ways, and one of the ways they did it was to make a good price point on the book, first of all. So most bestsellers, most paperbacks sell for, let's say, $15, $16 a piece, $14. I think mine was priced at $12, so if I'm next to an author that you've already heard of, what's going to make you take a risk on me? If I'm new, let's price it a little bit below that, and maybe you'll pick mine off the shelf. There's one thing. Indie bookstores, to me, and also like Barnes & Noble, those have been amazing for me, because if those booksellers like your book, they're going to recommend your book to shoppers when they come in and ask for suggestions. So I still love brick-and-mortar stores and very much love and think we need real bookstores to walk into and have those people who love books telling you about books and hand-selling those books. So as authors, we rely very much on that word of mouth as well, that those booksellers have read us and recommend us. And then I don't know that any of that would have gotten me on a bestseller list, though. I think that my publisher worked with Amazon to run a one-day free promotion on my book. And that on my ebook, and that brought me up in the charts on Amazon enough that people started to see the book, read the summary of the book, the synopsis, notice the book. It did so well that day that it was called an Amazon Best Mover and Shaker. And so then Amazon noticed, and they started including it on some of their ebook promotions. So some of their emails that go out and their newsletters, it was listed as the best mover and shaker of the day and that kind of thing. So as that trickled out, I mean, I'm sure Amazon's email list is enormous, more people noticed it. So Amazon does a lot to help debut authors too. And that helped my book move up on the Amazon charts. And thankfully, people gave it a shot because it's free. What do they have to lose? Thankfully, people seemed to like it. And they went on. Now, these are people who don't know me, don't owe me anything, will never meet me. These were just generous readers who, after they read the free book, went online on Amazon and posted positive reviews about it. That is so helpful to us as authors. So as those reviews built up and everybody started noticing the book a little bit more and more and more, that trickled out. And when the free promotion ended, the publisher and the Amazon worked together to stage up the pricing. So then it went up to, I don't know, 99 cents and then $2.49. And it just kind of slowly trickled up to the normal price. And by that time, people were really buying the book. And so a week or two later is when I think it hit the New York Times bestseller list, first as an ebook. It ended up spending 3 weeks on that list and on the USA Today Top 150, and it crossed over to print sales, too. So that was huge. I think a lot of it was luck and timing and a lot of other miraculous things in life, but I know that I wouldn't have ended on that bestseller list if the book had just been lost at sea with 8 million other copies. So I'm very grateful for Amazon, for my publisher, Cook, and for the readers who took a chance, and then the readers who, after they read it, supported it, because they could have read it for free and then never told a soul, and that would have defeated the whole purpose. So you get noticed first, but if the readers don't support it and like it and share it, it doesn't do any good. So I think all of those magic ingredients have to come together, and thankfully they did.
Wow. Well, now, as I understand it, you didn't write into the free for a Christian market, but you have a Christian publisher. So how does that work? It feels like Into the Free is a crossover book that sells equally well in Christian and regular stores. Can you talk a little bit about writing for the Christian market and how that all happened?
Yeah, you know, I think, as I told you, my first two picture books were, they were called God is with Me Through the Day and God is with Me Through the Night. There ended up being two in that contract. So they were published through Zondervan, which is now under Random House, but at the time it was just Zondervan, an independent Christian publisher, and they were published through their children's division. But I knew that those books had to go to a publisher that was comfortable publishing something about God. But the novel, I didn't necessarily see it as a Christian novel. It was, to me, it's set in Mississippi in the 1920s and 30s. And the South is a very Christian culture, and it does explore religion, but it's not written. Okay, here's the thing. I didn't know enough at the time when I was writing that book or selling that book to even know there was such a thing as a Christian publishing column and a secular publishing realm. I didn't know that there were two different branches to that tree. Now, it's really interesting to see how the two realms are merging more and more by the day, but traditionally, you have to think about what Christian publishers did. My publisher, Cook, has been around for like 100 years, but these publishers were created to serve a need in the ministry. So they published curriculum materials, Bible studies, Bibles, devotionals. Cook does a lot of music and things like that, things that are used in the ministry. They weren't comfortable for a long, long time publishing fiction. It wasn't what they did. So as these publishing companies started kind of dipping their toes in that water, they didn't really know what to do with fiction. So at first, it was very overt, simple, preachy kind of books that could be used in Sunday school classes to study a certain moral lesson or moral topic, but it was kind of distributed in a fiction-y way. So that wasn't ever really what I read. I wasn't drawn to those kind of books on the shelves. I didn't know a lot about Christian fiction or that part of the publishing world. So when that's where my book landed, I wasn't opposed to it because I consider myself a Christian, and I do personally feel like things happen for a reason, and this has kind of happened in my life for a reason, and I'm going to go where those doors open, and I'm being driven by a bigger force than me. So I accept those as gifts in my life, and I'm not going to question any of that at all. So I was not opposed to being called a Christian writer or the book being labeled Christian fiction, but I did not want to alienate a readership because maybe they did not consider themselves Christian or didn't typically read Christian fiction and didn't want the book to be put into a certain bucket. But it wasn't. Amazingly, and that's a rare feat, I think, but becoming more and more common in the Christian realm. This book did cross over, and I don't think people see it as necessarily an overt Christian story. I definitely have gone to book groups with atheists, agnostics, Muslims, Jewish people, all kinds of, and that's how my friends are. We have a big wide range of readers for this book, and I think it's just one of those books that talks about universal searching and longing for a meaning in life, and the faith questions of, you know, is there something bigger than us in the universe, and what is the purpose of all of this? And most people I know, no matter what we call ourselves, believe in something bigger than ourselves. So that's the kind of book that it is to me. And usually we put a name on our faith of what we've been taught. And for me, it's Christianity. And that's where the book falls. But I'm very, very lucky and feel grateful that the book has reached a lot of people beyond that normal scope. And a lot of people have written to me about that and how the book has helped them cope with really bad things that happen in their lives, abuse, you know, some difficult topics that are approached in the book, and it's been life-changing for a lot of readers. And to me, that's been the most incredible part about publishing this book, not the sales or the award list or the starred review or anything like that. All of that's been wonderful, icing on the top, but the real gift of this book for me has been the reaction from readers who felt like it changed their lives. So if to me, whatever they want to call it, Christian, and it kind of is. If you look across the shelves, it's been labeled all different kinds of things: Christian fiction, Southern fiction, literary fiction, contemporary fiction, and historical fiction, which is because it falls in that weird kind of Great Depression, World War II era, and that's right where the cutoff is. All kinds of things. It's crazy what it's been labeled. And again, I didn't write it with a certain label in mind, and I think it was one of those funky, weird books that nobody really knew what to do with. And that was the big risk and the gamble for John Blaise and Cook, because it could have fallen in no man's land and reached nobody. But thankfully, it did the opposite and reached a broader spectrum than we could have ever hoped. So I've been happy with that.
Well, it's so exciting for you. And I think our listeners are anxious to ask questions, so I'm going to go ahead and unmute the line and let people ask questions. Everybody be prepared, because it might get really, really loud now, but I want to give people a chance to ask questions. So it'll just take me a second, and if you decide not to ask questions, that's fine. I have a few more for Julie, because she has so many interesting things to talk about. So, does anybody have a question for Julie?
Can I get Julie's full name?
It's Julie Cantrell, Cantrell.
I've got a question for her. I wonder how she's using social media to promote herself.
That's a really good question. And again, I think there's such a fine line of kind of putting your message out there and also not just annoying people to death with this self-promotion. It's so icky for me because, as I said, I was never even one that sold stuff for fundraisers in school or Girl Scouts or anything. It is so awkward for me to ask people for help or support or to buy something. So I find it hard, personally. I try to be active. Also, I'm just so busy. I try to get on Facebook a couple of times a week and respond and interact with people on Facebook and Twitter. I do blog on several blogs. I blog on, I'm really excited. I just got chosen as the Wednesday Bell for the Southern Bell View blog. It's a group of five Southern female artists. We kind of sit on a cyber porch and each blog a different day. And we have a great blog there. So I'm excited about that. And I also blog with my WordServe literary agency. We've got over 70 authors that blog on the WordServeWaterCooler.com. And that's a great resource for writers because writers of all different levels of the industry, all these phases, and we talk about all different kinds of topics about writing and publishing. So that's a great resource for being able to do that. You know, I try to just be as connected as I can on a personal level and try not to overwhelm people with the sales message. Even though I do have to promote things and tell people about opportunities and offers, I try really hard not to spam them with that. It's really icky to me. Do you have any suggestions on ways to use it, that you've used it or have seen people use it?
I've done it a couple of different ways, but, you know, you get kind of mixed reviews. And what's weird is you'll put something out that you think is really great and nobody responds, and then you throw something up thinking about, and you get all these responses. And I can't figure out the algorithm.
I don't think there is one. I have seen some really interesting marketing studies on best time of day to post something on Facebook and Twitter and how many words it needs to be and what keywords seem to get the most traction and all of it. You can Google those kind of things and get that kind of data analysis, really want algorithm for it. I don't do that. I just kind of pretty quickly shoot out whatever's on the top of my head for the moment, and I don't really use it as a strategic marketing tool. But I have found that people on Facebook have been so supportive and share things and support things a lot more than you would ever think people could. They're very generous and want to see people succeed. So I think I rely a lot on readers and friends.
Thank you. Other questions? And if you're not going to ask a good question, it would be great if you muted yourself by pushing *6 because it does get kind of loud on the line. So if you're not going to ask a question, go ahead and push *6. If you have a question, this is a great time to ask it.
Great banana.
Anybody have a question?
Yes, I have a question. I would like to know how to encourage other authors to let their characters, instead of the description of the characters, come through.
Oh, that's a really good question. And for me, my answer is I write in first person. So I feel like you're more connected to me as a character if I'm writing in first person. And if I'm telling you about someone or telling you about myself, I'm not going to just sit there and list off a list of descriptions about what I look like. I guess because that's the way I kind of am in real life, I couldn't hardly ever tell you what someone looks like or what they have on or what they drive. But when I walk away from a conversation, I can tell you everything about their personality, their family, their life, how they're feeling, all of that about them. But if I saw them 5 minutes later, I might not recognize them. That's just how my brain works. So I guess that's the tool I use in writing. I try to get into that inner part of the character more than just the description part. And a long time ago, I realized when I was reading, I didn't want a lot of descriptions about a character's physical qualities. I kind of wanted to build that for myself and my brain, how I wanted that character to look. So even on the covers of books, I don't usually like to see a certain image of a character because that might not be the way I picture them. You know how, like, for example, if you read a book that you loved or a book series that you loved, maybe Harry Potter or something, for example, I'm thinking of one that reached a lot of adult, young adults, big audience across the world, and then you go to the movies and you see those actors portraying those characters, you can't read that next book in the series without picturing those actors in your head for those characters. And it kind of changes the way you journey through that story. So to me, I like to leave that a little bit vague and tell you the inner part of the character and their journey and not necessarily the outer part. Although you have to give your reader some cues. They don't have to be real descriptive. But let me give you another example because I'm not being clear. I don't need to know that somebody has long nails necessarily unless she's tapping those nails on the desk and annoying me. A lot of people have long fingernails, so that's not necessarily a characteristic that's going to stick in my head or make her a certain, you know, it's kind of a stereotypical characteristic. But if she uses them to do something that shows her personality, then it matters. Does that make sense? If somebody has perfect hair and they are constantly looking in the mirror and fixing their hair or spraying their hair, or they spend 4 hours a week at the hair salon, then that says a lot about their personality. But otherwise, their hairstyle doesn't really matter to me. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense, Julie. And I've been reading. There's a ton of new books on reading and what it does for our brains. And one of the things that reading does for our brains is it gives us the opportunity to kind of dream awake. And so the author's job is to kind of sketch out some of the details, and we fill them in our head, and that's part of the joy of reading, is to fill in that house, you know, to fill in Harry Potter's room under the stairs and to kind of put Hogwarts together brick by brick in our brain. And I know as a reader, I will not see a movie if I haven't read the book because it just ruins it for me. I have to read the book first. Go ahead. I would love to have some more questions for Julie. If you're not going to ask a question, why don't you push mute, star six will mute you, and that will take care of some of the extra noise we're hearing. But if you have a question, why don't speak up. We'd love to hear from you. Other questions from folks? Well, while you're thinking and getting your courage up, Julie, I know you have a full life. You work full time, you parent, you farm, you do speaking, and you're writing. How do you find time to write? What are some of the things that you do to make that possible?
Like I said, originally when I wrote the book, I was working full time, so I wrote from 3 to 5 in the morning. I still do that a lot. Just because once the day gets started, I hardly find time to write at that point. And once the book came out, I kind of thought things would slow down, but they got really, really busy. There's a lot that goes on before the book comes out with marketing and contacts and interviews and all of that, but it doesn't slow down afterwards. You get really a lot of time a day has to be spent with emails and answering questions and interviews and workshops and speaking and you know, all of that. Of course, I don't have anybody that does all that for me. I have to do it. So it just takes a lot of time that I would normally maybe have spent writing. So it's hard. I wish I had a perfect answer for that, but I really try to just zap any amount of time I have that I can get to the computer and write. I used to try I will say it's hard to go back and forth, especially as a teacher. I teach kindergarten and first grade English as a second language. If anybody on the line is a teacher, you know that you come home from teaching, especially with young children, completely drained. Your creative resource is tapped out. So you can't just jump on the computer and jump right into writing a novel. It doesn't work, or my brain doesn't work that way. I try, but I always have to go back and kind of fix what I've written when I'm in that state of mind. So I wish I had, it kind of takes me a little bit longer to get down into that zone. And once I'm in it, I don't want to get out, but I have to because I have to go to work or whatever else I've committed to doing. So I don't know. I think that's my biggest challenge absolutely in my life right now is just finding time to get it done. But it's still a top priority for me, and I just try to do it every chance I can.
That's great. And what are you working on now? What books do you have in process?
Well, I have the sequel to Into the Free. I just finished the first round of edits last night, just sent it off last night and today. So we'll go through the rest of those rounds of edits, and hopefully it'll be on shelves by September of 2013 through same publisher, David C. Cook. It's what happens next in Millie's life. I'm hoping it can be a standalone book in a series, but it's also just, you know, the next phase of what happens to that main character, Millie Reynolds, that was portrayed in Into the Free. So that's done. We've still got a lot of work to do on it, but that book has been written. I'm excited to say that I finished it last night. That feels good. Lots more work to go, but it's there. It's on the page. I've got two more books signed to write after that, two more novels. I've also been kind of playing on the back burner for a while now with a creative nonfiction book about our family's journey as we have learned to be farmers. We started a farm about 2 years ago. We have a sustainable farm with milk goat, dairy goats, chickens, hair sheep, horses, lots, you know, just the whole thing, organic gardens, berries, honeybees, all of that. So we do all of that ourselves. We have finally gotten a student to help us in the last couple of months, and that's been helpful. But it's been a really interesting adventure for our family, and I think we could write a funny book about that. So my husband is an organic chemist with the USDA, and he's writing kind of the scientific part and the how-to and the step-by-step details of how to do a farm and finding the animals and breeding the animals, all the stuff that goes into it. And I'm writing the funny stories about how many times we mess up and how many times a day we ask ourselves why we're doing it and then how much we love it, too, and how much it's given to our family. So that's a little project, too, I'm doing on the side. And then I still do lots of freelance stuff and just wrote little things here and there, like a devotional for a new Bible coming out on grief that's by Zondervan and parenting stuff that comes here and there, school books. I don't know. It's little things all the time. So, but mainly the novels are my top priority right now.
And do you find yourself spending all day Saturday and Sunday writing, or do you try to spend that with the kids or on the farm, or how do you manage to juggle those things?
You know, I will always say my kids are my top priority. My family first, always. I will never, I hope to goodness, my kids don't grow up and say all they remember about me is that I was writing books. I just, boy, would I have failed in life if that's what they remember about me. So I try really hard. And at first, they never saw me writing. I just never took time away from them to do that. Now they're in high school and junior high, so a lot of times we'll all be in the living room together, and we're all on the computers doing different things because that's what they want to be doing too. So I'll be sitting there writing, and they're playing their video game, or they're reading something online or watching a YouTube video or whatever it is they do online, you know, now. But we'll all be there together, and we'll share things off and on each other. I have never had the luxury of writing without being interrupted constantly. I don't have, like, a little den I go hide away in or a cabin or so I'm used to writing with constant chaos all around me, and that doesn't bother me at all. So I'd rather write with my family with me. And if I have to put stop in the middle of a paragraph and put it down and go play a game or go outside and do something, that's just the way it goes, and I just have to come back to it and do the best I can. Yeah, so that's how it is for us. My family definitely comes first. I know that this year has been tough on all of us. It's been so busy, and you know, eventually something probably going to have to give. We're all trying to juggle a whole lot of balls right now, but we're all very happy, and everything we're doing is important to us, and we love it. So, you know, our kids are both really busy too. So that's all, you know, everybody who's moms know how much time that takes, just getting them to all of their things and being there to support them and the stuff that they do. So we're all just doing what we can.
That's great. Well, we're almost out of time. So do you have a final piece of wisdom you'd like to offer to our listeners today?
Just write, because it makes you happy and because you love it, and don't really worry about any of the rest. I think it falls into place as it's supposed to, and you can learn all of those craft skills and the structuring, and take the advice of your editors. They are very important, and my book could not be anywhere like it is without my editors. There's many of them. But Nikki Jordan Hubert gets a lot of credit as my main editor, and she's brilliant. So I think you just have to trust that it's a team sport, trust everybody that's involved in it. They all know more than we do. We bring the idea to the table. We create the world, but we need a lot of other people to make it readable and shareable. So just write because it's what you do and who you are and what makes you happy.
Oh, Julie, thanks so much for being with us. This has been lovely. Everybody, I want to let you know that I'll be sending out the recording later in the week, and with that I'll be sending some links to Julie's website and Facebook page and where to buy her book and all of that good stuff, as well as to the resources she recommended on today's call. I'll be in touch later in the week with all of that information. Until then, this is Rochelle, the Right Now Coach, and you have been at the Right Now Mastermind class. Thanks, Julie, and thanks to everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.